Hello and welcome to Politico's 2016 Nerdcast, where we bring you the stories behind the stories and geek out on this amazing circus of an election. It's Thursday, November the 3rd, and I'm Kristen Roberts, national editor. There were so many numbers that mattered this week. I'm just going to summarize them for you. 0.3 or 3.9. That's how much the margin between Clinton and Trump has tightened since Friday's FBI news, depending on which polling average you subscribe to. 259. That's the number of electoral votes Donald Trump has if he wins all the Romney states and Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and North Carolina. And 13%, that's the decline in early voting so far by African Americans in North Carolina, a shift that's being seen in Florida and other key states. And stick around at the end for a quick rundown of all the special Nerdcast episodes we're going to give you next week, before, during, and after the results. I'll walk you through the plan at the end of the show. So now, grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. Here we go again. Hello, Charlie Mattesian.
Hey, Kristen.
Scott Bland, welcome back.
Happy November, Kristen.
Hi, Ken Vogel.
Hey.
We've got another great question from one of our listeners. Everybody, please join me in saying hello to Tony from New Jersey. Hi, Tony.
Hello, party people.
Tony, what is your question?
Okay, my question. So for Trump, we seem to have an empirical, verifiable list of demographics in which he is doing poorly, underperforming Romney, et cetera. With Clinton, I know she's unpopular in a general sense, but does she have a comparable hit list of specific weak points as deep and as damaging as Trump's appear to be? And I'm not asking like out of partisanship or anything, but I just haven't seen numbers as bad for her as I've seen for him. So does she have such a hit list? If so, what is on it? And if she doesn't have one, how can the race be so close?
Great question, Charlie.
That's my question.
Jump in.
Well, I'll start with one broad area where Hillary Clinton has a real problem, and this is more of a character issue, and it's the problem is her honesty and trustworthiness. This is something that's been pretty consistent in the polls. We've seen people really didn't trust her for months now, and in fact, in the latest ABC News Washington Post poll, we see that she trails Donald Trump for the first time in this campaign in who voters see as more honest and trustworthy. So think about that. Voters, according to this poll, think Donald Trump is more honest and trustworthy than Hillary Clinton. Now, some of that is, reflects fallout from the renewed FBI scrutiny of Clinton-related emails. But still, you know, that reflects some pretty consistent and deep reservations about her honesty and trustworthiness. Now, when it comes to demographic groups, I mean, if you're talking about sort of the crosstabs in the polls, what they show is, you know, Hillary Clinton is much weaker with white voters. She's losing white voters, for example, in the CBS New York Times poll that just came out. She's losing white voters 49-37. She's also struggling among white men 49-38. And again, those are pretty consistent for a Democrat, so that's not really a Hillary Clinton problem. But here's where the numbers get even worse. So she's got a gender gap problem where among white men, she trails by 25 points, 56-31 in this new CBS New York Times poll. So big problem with white men, but the real big problem also is white non-college grad, which is the Donald Trump sweet spot. So she's losing among them 55-30. One other group that I think is probably worth noting, since we're breaking it out that way, and that would be young voters. You know, obviously she struggled in the primaries, and we saw that against Bernie Sanders. And it took a while for them to warm up to Hillary Clinton. And in fact, I don't think we saw much of that for much of the general election. They actually flocked to the third party candidates. But I think after the debates, we began to see a little more movement from young voters toward Hillary Clinton because they're not crazy about her, but they really dislike Donald Trump. So that those are sort of, I think, the bigger demographic groups that I think that she has some problems with.
Scott?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Charlie just said, Tony. And I think, you know, the other thing I would add is that, you know, I think one of the issue you're hitting on is that when we kind of split out demographic groups to talk about, you know, we often aren't talking about, you know, the size of the electorate they are, but the fact that Donald Trump is very unpopular among African Americans, Hispanics, Asian American voters, et cetera, kind of adds up to a similar number of people who, as Hillary Clinton is unpopular with among non-college educated whites. And so, you know, I think that it's, you know, it's, we've certainly like talked a lot more about the differences among white voters in this election than before. But I think sometimes the size gets lost a little bit in that discussion. You know, what the 2/3 to 3/4 of the electorate in the states and country are still white for all the demographic change that's going on.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thanks, Charlie. And thank you, Tony. What a good question. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Let's get to our first data point. It is 650,000. That's the number of emails found on a laptop used by, wait for it, Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin, according to the Wall Street Journal. Now, the paper, and as I've said before, this is the best newspaper in America, reports that metadata suggests thousands of those emails could have been sent to or from Hillary Clinton's private email server. Given the extraordinary timing and impact this has had on the race, we have asked Josh Gerstein, our White House correspondent who covers legal and court issues and is generally a mensch, to join us for some straight talk. Josh, thank you for doing this.
Hey, no problem.
We also have Ken, who has been covering this and is just generally a smart guy about all legal things.
And if by covering this you mean reading Josh's stuff and
that's
then going on TV
doing,
to talk
too.
About it and claim credit for it, guilty
and
as
listening
charged.
Listening to me interview people.
Right.
You're terrible. Okay, let's start with facts. What exactly did James Comey do last week with 11 days left? Did he reopen the case or not? Josh?
Well, I'm told that the case was never really technically closed. While he had announced that they didn't plan to prosecute anyone, there were a lot of steps needed to shut down the investigation. They hadn't all been taken. I've referred to it as reinvigorating or renewing the investigation. So he did announce that they decided that there was new evidence on that laptop that they needed to look at, and that it was appropriate to do that. It meant essentially trying to move some of that information from the people who were looking at it, which was an FBI team looking into Anthony Weiner's alleged sexting escapades with an underage girl, to the team that handled the Clinton email investigation. And the notice that went to the Hill was basically letting those congresspeople and lawmakers know that they were going to be renewing at least this aspect of the Clinton email probe.
Now, what do we know about these emails? Do we know anything about these emails?
Well, we know, while there's 650,000 emails on this laptop, Abedin's people say this is not her laptop, and it really wasn't shared, that she never installed any email account on there. So the number of emails that actually belong to her, we believe, is much smaller. I kind of doubt that there's an actual account from ClintonEmail.com on there, because Huma Abedin has said previously that she only accessed ClintonEmail.com through a web interface. And I don't know why that would lead to thousands of messages being on there, various theories about how it might have gotten on there. We assume that these are of a similar kind to the other hundreds of thousands of emails the FBI has already gone through. And they're going to need to look at them to see if there's A, classified information there, or B, you know, something inculpatory that, you know, says I'm setting this system up in order to avoid the law, or let's destroy these emails in order to, you know, cover up something. That's what the FBI is going to be looking for.
Is there any chance this is resolved in the next 5 days?
It's not going to be fully resolved. There's some small possibility that if a lot of these Abedin emails turn out to be duplicates of ones that were seen earlier in the investigation, or near duplicates, meaning it's her just adding please print, or Hillary adding something please print, then it's possible we might hear that before Tuesday, that this is entirely or almost entirely duplicates of things the FBI saw already. I'm kind of doubtful that that's the case. I bet there's at least some emails here that are new, and even a few of those is going to make it difficult for the FBI to issue a statement like
Ken,
that.
Go ahead.
I mean, you'd have to hope so. You'd hope that there were new emails, or it would just raise really pointed questions about why Comey would do this if there was not something new. There was some confusion about to what degree the FBI had actually, or the FBI Washington office, which is handling the investigation into Hillary Clinton, had actually reviewed these emails before Comey went and made this announcement. What's your understanding about what the FBI knew and what Comey knew and what access he had?
So this is the reason that people are cagey about that is because it's a legally like sensitive issue. The search warrant was to look for records relating to Anthony Weiner sexting with a minor, a message from Humid Abedin to Hillary Clinton or anyone else on Hillary Clinton's staff is not evidence of him sexting with a minor. So they're really not supposed to look at that stuff. We believe they opened up the huge cache of emails and looked at the metadata, the from, the to, the time sent, the account sent from, and they started seeing messages that seemed to be work-related Huma Abedin messages. Whether they looked at the body of any of those messages, I don't know. So they may not know what the substance is. Technically, they're not really even supposed to be looking at the subject line, but maybe you would see one while looking for something else. And until last Sunday, they didn't have a warrant to look at that stuff. And so if the FBI did look at it, it's awkward for them to admit it because they really weren't supposed to be doing that unless they literally stumbled over it.
But didn't Weiner give them permission to look through these things?
I don't believe that Weiner did. My understanding is that these were seized from him, that there was one set of warrants to take several of Anthony Weiner's devices, and they were surprised to find this Huma Abedin information on there. And curiously, she claims she's surprised that it's on there. She says that she, like I said, never installed any accounts on there. People are wondering if it got on there in some kind of cloud backup, or maybe that this was a laptop that replaced a laptop they had earlier and somebody copied the entire contents of the previous laptop on there. She claims to be, as we've reported this week, in the dark about why, frankly, any of her emails are on this computer.
Yeah, the other thing that I think is so surprising about the FBI's process here that you broke this week was that the FBI never asked Hillary Clinton's top aides to turn over all the computers and devices they used while she was Secretary of State. Conceivably, this computer may have been, not definitely, but may have been turned over had they asked for that. So there is a lot of criticism, I think rightfully so, about Hillary Clinton and her team and their failure to be fully and immediately forthcoming with these emails, producing these emails, or talking to the public about why they did this stuff. But I think at least a little bit of fault and blame has to be directed towards the FBI and their handling of this, which I think put us in this position where we have a potential revelation, a very vague but potential revelation 11 days out from the election.
Right. And this is something Republicans are very worked up over. They've been saying for months that they think the FBI did this in two deferential way. It was all done through cooperation and agreements and sometimes immunity agreements with various witnesses in the Clinton email probe. As far as we know, they never convened a grand jury. They never served search warrants. They never used the usual tactics that you use when you're investigating criminal activity or potential criminal activity. It was done in much more of sort of a gentleman's investigation, if you will, or gentle ladies investigation. And Republicans are raising questions about those tactics and find it odd that the minute the FBI switched to some of its more usual tactics, as they apparently used in this Anthony Weiner underage sexting investigation, boom, all of a sudden we have some evidence that we didn't expect to have. And to them, at least to the Republicans on the Hill, it underscores the notion that the FBI wasn't hitting as hard on this as they should have.
Ken, if this doesn't necessarily affect Election Day, and I don't know that it will, what is the impact?
Well, if Hillary Clinton wins, I think we just saw the beginning of what the next 4 years or 8 years is going to look like, which is full on investigative trench warfare with a Republican Congress, definitely a Republican House, maybe a Republican Senate, issuing subpoenas, going just aggressively at any number of these scandals, and I use air quotes around them. I'm not minimizing them and saying that they're not worthy of investigation, but the vigor with which they will pursue them, I think, will be the predominant story for the next 4 years if Hillary Clinton is president.
And I think, you know, not to call out the false equivalence police will come after me for this, but really either candidate who wins faces a tremendous legal investigative hangover after the election. Donald Trump has his Trump University lawsuits. He has his Trump restaurant lawsuits. He has the 14 women that he's promised he's going to sue for libel and defamation after the election. You have the women saying they're going to sue him back. And then on Clinton's side, you have this entire email mess. either candidate who wins is going to be tied up in a legal imbroglio that will stretch for at least months after the election, if not years.
Josh, I know how busy you are, so thank you, thank you, thank you for doing this.
Oh, happy to do it.
Let's get to our next data point. It's a twofer. It's 0.3 or 3.9. That's how much the margin between Clinton and Trump has tightened since Friday's FBI news, depending on which polling average you subscribe to. Now, Scott, the indisputably partisan Huffington Post puts the shift at the smaller number. Real Clear Politics says it's the larger number. Why the difference, and is that difference meaningful?
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. I mean, we've been told, you know, by all the smart people for years now, look to the polling average, you know, like stop talking about individual polls, look at the polling average. Those will provide clarity. Turns out there are, you know, different polling averages show different things. And yes, the Huffington Post is partisan, but they've got a team of data scientists, you know, PhDs and whoever else who take care, who manage the polling section of their website in a very, very organized and professional way. They have great charts, great data on all the different races. And they're, you know, what they're saying, looking at the multitude of state and national polls that have come out since Friday, since the news broke that the FBI was looking once again into emails related to Clinton's private server, that the race has barely budged. Real Clear Politics, which always has a kind of more bouncy look at the polls, says that it has budged in an enormous fashion. And so, you know, I just think it's interesting, like partisans don't even have to cherry pick their, you know, an individual poll here or there anymore to get the outlook on the race they want. They can cherry pick their own polling average at this point.
But isn't it also that they're using different polls, meaning the threshold for what Real Clear Politics uses is different than the threshold for what HuffPo uses? And that can make a big difference. I mean, we've seen that. And then the other question I would have is also Real Clear Politics is just a pure polling average, no seasoning at all, whereas the HuffPo model is a little different, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that gets built into these. Huffington Post and I believe 538 and some of the other ones out there, they try and build into their models what's called house effect, right? So if a certain poll is typically, say, 2 points more Democratic-leaning than the average of all of them, then what they'll do is in their model, they will adjust that poll 2 points to the right to try and get rid of that so-called house effect. I don't think Real Clear Politics does it. But that's the thing. Like these things, I think Huffington Post has a pretty lengthy, you know, several thousand word methodology written on their site. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that for Real Clear. It's not, even though they are the most widely used polling average out there, certainly most widely cited, I think. It's not entirely clear how they do it.
You know, we get emails. We got an email late last night on just this subject of someone who was alleging that Real Clear just cherry picks polls, that they'll leave out polls without any real explicable reason, except the emailer believes that the polls that they leave out are those that favor Democrats. So, you know, it's actually that they cite a particular poll that Real Clear left out, and I don't know, you know, the specifics of the poll or whatever, but, you know, it certainly raised a valid question. Intuitively, though, I just have to think that the news about the emails, though it got a ton of attention and though we, you know, devoted a ton of resources to covering it, really was not news. There was not a whole lot of news there, and there was certainly not revelatory, and I think it was certainly not revelatory in a way that would convince any undecided voter, anyone who's on the fence, to either vote against Hillary Clinton or to vote for Trump. The news about the emails has been out there for months and months and months. This didn't advance the story, didn't have any specifics. It was totally vague in a way that, you know, I think was puzzling that Comey would come out and say what he said without any details. Just spun everyone into a tizzy. And, you know, perhaps at the margins, I could see it helping Donald Trump get out his vote, rally his supporters by, you know, having a renewed data point to suggest that Hillary Clinton is corrupt, which he has certainly seized upon. But as far as convincing undecided voters or voters who were thinking about voting for a soft commits to Hillary to vote for Trump, I just don't see it.
Do you buy that, Charlie?
I'm not so sure what I think on this question. I mean, the data seems to suggest very little effect, if any. But I do think that where we'll see it make a difference, and it could have a material effect, is on the Republican side, meaning there are lots of states where Donald Trump is not nearly strong enough among Republicans. He's in the 70s or 80s when he needs to be in the 90s to win those states. Now, if you're in that 10 to 20% of Republicans, does this push you over the edge? Where is it the tipping point where you finally say, enough is enough? I cannot deal with the Clintons anymore. Does this get you there? It might in some states. And even if that's a small number of Republicans, that makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, especially you've seen Trump's numbers of support among Republicans lag consistently far behind Romney in 2012. Romney lost, so you need to get to at least that close to that level. That's the storyline from Republicans, that Republicans, you know, from the Republican, the pro-Trump Republican establishment, suggesting that people who are on the fence or even anti-Trump are coming home.
And that's a really key distinction for the party in general, that 10 to 20%. I mean, there were a lot of fears in recent weeks among Senate and House Republican strategists that they weren't entirely sure what that 10 to 20% of Republicans who said they weren't voting for Trump were going to do. And the real concern was that not just that some of them would vote for Clinton, but that some of them would stay home and prevent, you know, Republican senators, Republican members of Congress from getting their votes down the ballot, and that it could end up being a real, you know, bottom falls out scenario on election day. I think that that may be the biggest effect of the FBI news, that it seems to have re-energized
That's
the Republican
really
base a little bit. And you know, according to our House reporters, made it a lot less likely that this doomsday scenario on election day will come to pass.
I mean, let's back up a little bit and remember the month of October, which included a very large number of surprises, starting with the New York Times getting the tax documents and then continuing on to, what was the next one?
The Trump tape, Access Hollywood.
Well, the Access Hollywood Trump tape was probably, when historians look at this election, the most pivotal moment in this campaign, right?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, it's like both, and we've just debated this here on Nerdcast, but both the Times story about Trump's taxes and the Access Hollywood tape, they just kind of confirm what we already suspected, but they did it in a way that really drove a ton of attention, got people talking, precipitated questions at the debate that Trump was forced to deal with. And, you know, it appeared as if Trump was done after both of those. Yet here we are.
Well, hold on, because I think that what the conclusion is that after the tax bombshell, and it was a bombshell in that moment, the numbers didn't move. The numbers actually didn't move decisively in this race until after the Access Hollywood tape, right?
True. But also now you see that things are tightening and people are, I think at least on the Republican side, you see some rollback. Trump seems to be getting, you know, gaining a little more momentum among Republicans. So ultimately, you know, the weird thing is, and this is something that we found in our reporting when we called, our reporters called lots of the locals, the county chairs, the state chairs on the Republican side. And I was amazed at how many of them told us, yeah, you know what? We always knew he was this kind of guy. We knew he was no saint. So, you know, a lot of this is baked in. Imagine almost any other nominee where you would have had those bombs dropped on their head. That would have been it. You know, for Trump, it's amazing, but a lot of people weren't really that surprised. And so I don't think it damaged him quite as much as it would have anyone else.
We could say that across all the October surprises, not just about Trump, but about That's Clinton, true. All the mm-hmm. stuff in WikiLeaks. I mean, I said this time and again, each morning, like I wake up and I just dive into those. They're like totally addictive. Like, someone's going to write a Pulitzer Prize winning book that leans heavily on the revelations in these WikiLeaks. And some of them are like quite compelling and provide quite a bit of context behind, again, some of the things that we already thought about how Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton political machine do business. And in any normal election year, those would be the definitive October surprises. But as with Trump, where people sort of already have this line of thinking, this perception of the way Hillary Clinton works, you know, that they and have a very strong sort of set of feelings about Hillary Clinton, who has very high negatives, it hasn't really, I mean, I haven't seen any evidence that anything in the any individual WikiLeaks based story has really affected the race that much or moved the numbers. Have you guys?
No, neither have I.
Is there anything really even new in there? I mean, it's fascinating stuff.
It's so fun to read, though.
It's great. The interpersonal relationships, the rivalries, all of it, you know, getting this, you know, front seat view of how that operation works. But I feel like I haven't learned anything that surprised me, like, oh, really, they're that way, or this person is completely different than I thought. Or what was the big revelation? I can't
John
think
Podesta's
of one.
Risotto recipe, I think.
Stop. No, there was serious stuff in there.
I mean, I agree with Charlie. There hasn't been a bombshell, but I think the reason is, frankly, like WikiLeaks can like look in the mirror and see why. Because it's the way that they've released these documents. I mean, they clearly believe that they have some sense. And I'm not going to minimize like their operation or their approach to things. They have devoted some thought to releasing that, to selecting documents that they believe drive a particular narrative and releasing them in a way that they think is going to drive the most news coverage. I just don't think it's been successful. And the reason why, as successful as it could have been, is that they're trickling these things out. And like I, you know, a reporter who's covered the Clintons for more than a decade, sort of knows what I'm looking for. And I go and I find stuff. I'm like, this is interesting. And I'll write a story about it. And then like 3 days later, they release something that was like the key nugget that I was waiting for that other story. And everyone's like, oh, you should totally write about this. And I'm like, nah, you know what? You missed your chance. I would have done it. I'm not going to do it now. And I think that it's because of the trickle of the WikiLeaks stuff that it's diminishing the impact. That's why I say that someone will write a book on this, because like after the election, someone will go back and comb through all the stuff and put it together in a way that doesn't necessarily produce any huge bombshells, but that really paints a compelling picture of the way that the Clintons operate in a way that we would not have been able to do without the WikiLeaks, because the Clintons are so adept at spinning and obfuscating when the press sort of reaches out or when there's scrutiny on a given issue. It's we see now through these WikiLeaks sort of what they really think and how they really operate. That's revelatory to me, but it's not revelatory in a way that produces necessarily a bombshell that's going to affect the election.
Let's bring it back to the now. Next data point, 259. That's the number of electoral votes Donald Trump has if he wins all the Romney states plus Florida, Iowa, Ohio, the states where he's ahead in the Politico battleground states polling average, and North Carolina, where he's within a point. Now, Charlie, these are the numbers that speak to the path to 270. These are the numbers that both campaigns care about. Let's talk about Trump's specific path. Where does he get the other 11 electoral votes?
This is the really hard part for Donald Trump. People need to forget for a moment what the national polls say and focus on, does he have a path to 270 through the battleground states? And it is an incredibly narrow path. And you just laid out why. So imagine he wins Florida and Ohio, these mega states, these giants that powered Obama. Even if Trump wins those and North Carolina and Iowa, he's still not at 270. And so what it tells you is two things. The path to the White House for Donald Trump requires winning all of those plus picking off a big state like Pennsylvania or Michigan. He must win another big state that's not even on the radar right now. And that's why you see him spending time in Pennsylvania. And I think that's why you see the Clintons freaking out a little bit about the state of Michigan right now, because Trump needs one more big state, or in the absence of a Pennsylvania or Michigan, he needs a couple of smaller states, meaning maybe Wisconsin plus New Hampshire, or Nevada plus one of the single congressional district votes out of Maine or Nebraska. So some combination of smaller states or one bigger one.
It's funny. We all thought going into this that, again, Florida would be the state that decided it. And in fact, it might be Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly. Or Michigan even. Michigan to me is the most interesting thing in the news today. So the story out of Michigan is that Bill Clinton had an unannounced meeting last night with top religious and political leaders in the city of Detroit. We also know that Hillary Clinton is going to be in Detroit on Friday, which is fairly amazing, given the fact that nobody has given a second thought to Michigan for a very long time. And the fact that those two, both of them, are going to be in Michigan in the final days of the campaign tells you that there is, you know, some concern, and the fact that they're in Detroit tells you it's about African-American turnout. And so something is going on there that they see. It doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to lose Michigan, but it does mean that they are seeing something, and there is a very strong sense of worry because Detroit is essential to a Democratic victory.
I find it very interesting that you just said that both Clintons particularly are going to be there and are very involved in this, because if we think all the way back to the primaries, Michigan was the site of a very, very surprising loss for Clinton to Bernie Sanders that really elongated that fight for the nomination, and kind of, you know, it was seen as one of those states that was going to help her put it away, and then Sanders kind of roared back to a very surprising win there. And I wonder if maybe there are some residual jitters left over from that as well, because that was not a result that the Clinton campaign internally saw coming either.
I mean, what they're looking at, you're right. If you look at the public polls, it's sort of inexplicable, because she's, you know, even the Real Clear Politics average has her up 7 in Michigan. Mm-hmm. What I think that they're looking at is early voting numbers, and those have been soft for Hillary Clinton, particularly in majority black areas. And you don't have to look a whole lot further than Detroit to find the sort of exhibit 1A in that. I think that is driving some serious concern in Brooklyn.
And part of the problem in Michigan is a little bit of a black box. It's not like Florida or North Carolina, where you have a lot more transparency in the numbers, where you know a lot because there's been a lot of votes cast. In places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, the early voting is very limited. They don't have early voting. They have limited absentee voting. So you have a very small data set to work with, and you don't have a ton of data about who is casting those votes. So you can sort of guess, but you don't really know too much about it, enough maybe to get scared. But again, like, the problem that Trump hits in Michigan, even if this is, let's just stipulate that minority turnout is low and worrisome for Democrats in Michigan, it's the same problem he hits in Wisconsin, and it's the same problem he hits in Pennsylvania. Places where there's a very similar political model, whereas you need, as a Republican, to win statewide, you have to win the suburbs or run much better than Trump is running to overcome the massive margins coming out of the state's biggest city. And in Detroit, you're going to have a massive margin. And the big problem that Donald Trump hits there is he's doing very well in Macomb County, you know, famous Macomb County that Clinton won in 92 and the, you know, famed home of the Clinton Democrats. He's winning among working class white voters there. But the problem is neighboring Oakland County, which is the white-collar, affluent suburb that produced Mitt Romney. He's doing very poorly there. And so that's the problem that Trump hits in Wisconsin and the Milwaukee suburbs. It's the problem that he hits in Philadelphia, which is that he's just not running well enough to carry these places. So it's hard for me to see Michigan coming through for him unless he changes the landscape in the suburbs.
Scott, let's talk about Hillary Clinton's problems. You suggested the number 13, which is a percentage. It's the decline in early voting so far by African Americans in North Carolina. And that's a shift that is being seen similarly in Florida and in some other battlegrounds. Now, the president is busy trying to drum up some enthusiasm among this group of voters. Do some math here for us. Clinton's team knew African American turnout would always be lower than it was during Obama's two elections, and they've been banking on Hispanic turnout. How does that affect the battlegrounds?
Yeah, it's a really shifting calculation from state to state, right? Obviously, you know, the exploding Hispanic turnout in Florida would make a much bigger difference in Florida than it would, say, in North Carolina or, you know, Ohio or elsewhere across the map. But you know, it's definitely been a drop off in terms of the early vote on the African American side. That, you know, we've seen President Obama on black radio and speeches talking about how that needs to be bumped up a little bit. And now, you know, we kind of get into this question of what exactly early voting means when we look at this, right? Because if what we're seeing, you know, I think there was a great quote from an old Obama advisor. I can't remember who it was, but an enthusiastic vote counts just as much as an unenthusiastic vote. And so if the question is, are African Americans just less likely to turn out overall And are, you know, are their numbers going to be less once we actually start counting on election day? Or are they just maybe less enthused and you know, some will kind of trickle to the polls later is a really interesting question that I don't know the answer to. But, you know, it kind of it gets into this whole mess of data that we're looking at right now with these polling numbers, post-FBI announcement and the early voting and everything else with, you know, just enthusiasm on both sides being kind of a wild card.
Charlie, you've been running all of the early voting stories and the reporters who've been working on that. What is your read walking into this weekend on the state of early voting and what impact it's going to have on the end result?
Well, it's really hard to tell because we've put a lot of reporting resources into it, as you know. And one of the things you discover when you devote a lot of reporter time to it and you do a lot of reporting there is everything is really relative. It's relative to the previous election cycle. It's relative to, you know, there are so many different variables when it comes to early voting. It's really hard to extrapolate. What I would say is that there are signs that, you know, what we talked about before, there are signs that minority turnout in some of the more important states, in some of the states where victory for Hillary Clinton is contingent on high African-American turnout, there are signs that, you know, there may be lagging there. And that's the bigger problem that they face, which is Hillary Clinton, for her to win, she has to replicate the Obama coalition. And that's a coalition that's grounded in young voters who aren't crazy about her, African Americans who like her a lot, but maybe not in the same to the same degree as Barack Obama, and Hispanic voters. And so what we're seeing out west is, you know, we see some conflicting numbers about Hispanic turnout. There's lots of signs that there has been increases in Hispanic voter registration, which is very promising for Hillary Clinton, given what we see in the polls and the levels of support she has among Hispanic voters. But one problem that you have when you look at the numbers is that most Hispanic voters are not necessarily in battleground states. They're concentrated in places like California and Texas, mm-hmm. Illinois, and New York. So when you look at the states that are ranked highest in number of Hispanics, those aren't states that are being contested now. The Hispanic vote Florida. And Hispanic, well, I was just about to get to that. So Florida matters a great deal to her, matters in New Mexico if New Mexico is, you know, in play, which I'm not so sure about. It matters in Colorado. So there are places where it does matter. It matters in Georgia. It matters in Arizona. So that, and every state has, you know, sort of a different regime. We have a pretty good idea about what's happening in Colorado. But again, you know, every state is different in terms of how much transparency you have into their numbers. And, you know, it's incomplete right now what everyone knows.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of saving grace when people talk about the effect of the FBI announcement, one of the things that Democrats look to and give them like a sense of you know that it wasn't as, it wouldn't have as significant effect as some Republicans were predicting was early voting that tens of millions of ballots had already been cast by the time that the FBI made this announcement, but what you're finding and what the reporting and the state secretaries of state offices are saying is that the early voting is not up significantly among the populations that would likely be Hillary Clinton supporters. Maybe that advantage is sort of offset and Democrats shouldn't be looking to that as a saving grace.
Ken, dive into your notebook for us, would you? I mean, you talk to both of these campaigns. Where are they truly most worried? I mean, we can guess based on where they're sending surrogates, right? What are they telling you and how worried are they really? Are they engaged in the classic lowering of expectations on the Clinton side? Does the Trump team really think it has a chance?
Yeah, the Trump team definitely thinks it has a chance. You know, they were pretty despondent there for a couple of weeks after the Access Hollywood tapes and the New York Times story. I mean, you know, we ran stories about the sort of fatalistic attitude, but it's interesting. I was talking to a source at Trump Tower who said that FBI news broke this past Friday, last Friday, and all of a sudden people came in Monday. They were peppy. They were talking about jobs in
the
administration.
They don't work on the weekend? Are you kidding me?
Well, this is a guy who maybe doesn't work on the weekends.
We're working weekends.
Or maybe he's just working from home. Give him the benefit of the doubt there. But saying that people started talking about what jobs they'd won in the administration and the White House and the Trump White House, which had not been happening for weeks and weeks. So an indication that they're feeling pretty good. And on the Democratic side, I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago, that there was this sense of overconfidence emanating from Brooklyn. There was some sign even back then that the higher ups there were concerned about that as well and didn't want people to get complacent. You heard that really seep into Hillary Clinton's rhetoric, not just after the FBI tape, even before the FBI made that announcement, where they were saying, you know, don't get complacent. You know, we still need to get out and vote. That's their message. Now, whether it's actually having an effect and people are, you know, shaking off that complacency, who knows?
So we're going to go to our final segment. It's a little different than anything that we've done before. Each member of our team here is going to talk about something that they think has emerged over the course of the 2016 presidential election cycle. A big takeaway. It's our attempt at starting to sum up this race. Ken, I'd like you to go first.
Yeah, so a number that jumped out at me this week was $10 million. That's how many dollars of Donald Trump's own money he injected into his campaign to power this last-minute advertising surge. You know, it doesn't get him anywhere near the $100 million that he bragged that he was going to spend on his campaign. He was at about $66 million, so not chump change, but not $100 million. But it's one more sign that, you know, with the president, with polls tightening and him actually seeing the possibility that he could be president of the United States, he is finally taking this thing seriously. We heard over and over again throughout the course of the campaign, the primaries and then the general election, that his advisors were pushing him not just to spend money, put more of his money in, but spend money generally on the types of basic politics 101 blocking and tackling that have been thought in the past to be critical to winning presidential campaigns. Yet here he is without having done all that this close, and he is, all signs suggest, getting really serious in a way that we haven't seen before, putting in money, spending money, staying on message, hammering Hillary Clinton over the FBI announcement. It makes you wonder what this race would have looked like if he had sort of started taking this thing seriously, maybe putting his own money in even earlier.
I think this is a fascinating issue because I think we all walked into the 2016 contest, which began, frankly, in like late 2014, early 2015, thinking the story about 16 would be a money story, but it certainly has not been the kind of money story that we thought it would be.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we all thought that this was going to be the super PAC election, that the super PAC, at least in the primaries, were going to be determinative and were going to help the candidate who had a bigger base of major donors just crush the field. And that didn't happen. That didn't happen in the primaries. Donald Trump won, despite the fact that he didn't even have a super PAC in the primaries, or certainly didn't have a robust one. And he was up against people like Jeb Bush, who had a $100 million super PAC. On the other side, you got Hillary Clinton with major big money support, big super PAC and 501c4 support. And she got a real run for her money, pun intended, from Bernie Sanders, who was not raising big money, instead really broke the model, broke records, raising huge sums of small dollar donations. So I think that caused a lot of people to rethink their assumptions about how the post-Citizens United world would look.
Charlie, you are up next. Shoot.
Okay. My data point is 2%. That's the percentage of voters, according to Pew Research, who say they will vote for Donald Trump for president and a Democratic candidate for the House. Now, that's exactly the same percentage who say they will support Hillary Clinton for president but vote for a Republican candidate for House. Now, the point here is that we are becoming more and more polarized, and the tradition of split ticket voting is fading to black, and this dumpster fire of an election is not helping things at all. Now, that's a trend that's been ongoing for some time. I looked at some numbers, and in 1972, this is unbelievable, especially if you follow House elections. In 1972, voters in 192 of our 435 congressional districts voted for one party for president and another for the House. That's 44%. Now, you fast forward to 2012, less than 10% of congressional districts voted for one party for president and another party for the House. And so, you know, it's just another sign of our battle lines on our worrisome levels of polarization. And, you know, it made me think a lot about, there was this guy I remember back in college, you know, he's an esteemed political scientist and real poli-sci geeks will know Walter Dean Burnham, who used to talk about, he had this great line that I thought was really terrific in explaining the American system. And he would say that political realignment was the American surrogate for revolution. So in other words, he would just basically say that our system is founded on mini revolutions that happen every couple decades. But it gets me to wondering, when I see numbers about these battle lines, that what happens when we stop realigning? What happens when we just get involved in this system of trench warfare where people just dig deeper and nothing changes? And so that is something I've been thinking about a lot when I look at the numbers.
But don't you think the realignment is happening within the parties? You know, you talk about like the Tea Party pulling the Republican Party further to the right, Donald Trump capitalizing on that. Donald Trump loses, that's, you know, an increasingly big if at this point. But if he loses, the Republican Party will be forced to realign. And if Hillary Clinton wins, certainly if she loses, the Democratic Party is already realigning and pulling further to the left on some of these economic populist issues. So it's just a different kind of realignment that we're seeing now.
I think it's just a realignment of power within the party. I think on the left, you see the rise of progressive power and the energy of progressive power. And on the right, you see the rise to power of a different vision of what conservatism means. I don't think outside the boundaries of the party, we're seeing much realignment though.
I think just to your point about the decline of ticket splitting, Charlie, I think, I mean, and, you know, it gets into what Ken just said about the realignment within the parties too. It's like, what reason does a Republican candidate for Congress give a Hillary Clinton voter for voting for them at this point? Or on the flip side, what reason does a Democrat running for Congress give someone who supports Donald Trump for supporting them? They, you know, when going back to 1972, like you were talking about, like Democratic members of Congress would work with President Richard Nixon and you know, fast forward 8 years with President Ronald Reagan, and in the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s, Jimmy Carter could count on Republican members of Congress to work with him, or, you know, Lyndon Johnson or Bill Clinton. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, and what's amazing is I've spent a lot of time in the last couple of weeks taking a look at older election maps and how presidencies were won. And what strikes me is how elastic the map was. Places changed, flipped between elections all the time. It was nothing like this hardened battle lines, hardwired political environment that we operate in now, where I think it's 40 of 50 states have voted the same way in the last five elections. It was nothing like that at all. And to me, it's a little scary, the fact that we've gotten so far away from that and people are so hardened.
Scott, your turn.
Yeah, my data point is actually very much related to this. It's the number 40 or so. And that's the number of Republicans in the House Freedom Caucus right now in the House of Representatives. It's, you know, this hardline group of Republicans that were responsible, among other things, for ousting John Boehner from the speakership, which amazingly was within this same election cycle. It feels amazing. Like forever ago. But and the reason I bring up that number is because I think that, you know, more so than in past elections, no matter which party loses, both of them are going through an internal remaking of themselves. And usually you see this on one side after losing a presidential election. There's a lot of introspection and kind of plotting and planning and movement about how to go forward. I really think no matter who wins, we're going to see it on both sides. And it starts on the Republican side with the Freedom Caucus, right, who are going to maintain this block within the House no matter the size of the Republican majority. And so if it is a smaller Republican majority, as we expect in 2016, they're going to have more influence to push the direction of their party. And, you know, we've already seen some pretty major proxy wars in House primaries across the map, with some big donors getting together and trying to, you know, using super PACs to take down a member of the Freedom Caucus in a primary in Kansas in August. And, you know, there's major repercussions kind of about that. That happened toward the end of the primary season, but that's going to definitely flip forward into 2018. And then on the Democratic side, you know, I'm not sure that it'll be much different, win or lose. You know, obviously, like the Bernie Sanders rise through the primary kind of laid bare a changing party that you know, Clinton had to grapple with, and as she was getting the nomination, not something that they had planned to do before. And if she wins, she's almost certainly going to be dealing with divided government from the get-go, which is not a recipe for mollifying the left wing of the Democratic Party, right? If she's going to have to be working with a Republican, at least partially controlled Congress to pass budgets and spending and all sorts of things. I just think it's going to be fascinating to see how this stuff works out.
Yeah, the Democratic Party has managed to paper over some of these divisions, but Charlie asked before about like the major takeaways from WikiLeaks. One of them is that Hillary Clinton, you know, while she did get to some of these progressive stances on trade and, you know, some of these other economic issues that Bernie Sanders really drove the narrative on, it was a fitful process, and there were many people within her inner circle who were dragging their feet on that. The revelations from that have progressives extremely on edge. We wrote a story about this, unwilling to give Hillary Clinton a honeymoon period where they'll just give her the benefit of the doubt on things like appointments or even her own like staff that doesn't require Senate confirmation. They're ready to go to war on some of these things, and they're not going to just get behind her agenda. So if you have a Republican Congress, potentially Senate and House, or at least the House, and you don't have significant support from the progressive base, you're really getting it from both sides.
Ken, I've been wondering about this. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about this. I mean, traditionally, when a new president is elected, they appoint one or maybe two cabinet secretaries from the other party as, you know, kind of a nod toward bipartisanship and, you know, bringing the country together. But does Clinton have the flexibility to do something like that? I mean, who would her Republicans be?
Well, I mean, she's got plenty of Democrats who progressives believe are Republicans.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, one of the guys who really, I'm serious, one of the guys who really is damaged in this is Jake Sullivan, who was her, I mean, he's a foreign policy guy, but these WikiLeaks emails showed that he just has tremendous influence over her entire agenda and positioning on domestic issues. And he really comes across as a Wall Street apologist. That's what progressives are looking for. It's not that they'll necessarily balk at any Republican, though I think that they probably will. It's they'll balk at anybody whose LinkedIn page shows anything related to Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, any of those big banks that she spoke to and praised. Another thing coming out of the WikiLeaks, her talking about the Goldman people are the smartest people in the room and this and that. Well, none of that helps with the progressive base, which is already on edge.
All right, it's my turn. My number is 32. It's the percentage of Americans who trust the media a great deal or even just a fair amount. So I think everybody in this room and all of our listeners will know already just how much I hate spending time whining about how hard it is to be a reporter or an editor for that matter. But let me say this, my main takeaway of the 2016 contest sitting here 5 days out, exhausted, is that the country is in a trust crisis. And this election is not the beginning of the end of it. It's like really just chapter one. And if Americans don't trust their press to work for the people and not the institutions, then really a fundamental pillar of our American democracy is on the verge of what I see as a catastrophic fail. The media needs to spend 2017 trying to right its relationship with America. And remember that journalism is a public service. I think we've all gotten real far away from that.
Yeah, I think it's not just the media. It's all the sort of institutions that are seen as the pillars of America, that are like seen as like the elite pillars of American life. So that is Wall Street. That is the media. That is politics. I mean, you know, I do think that we've talked a little bit debated about like where Trump fits and the sort of evolution of this. But like, I think that we really saw this percolating around 2008 with the bailouts and the bipartisan backlash against the bailouts that ended up sort of spawning the Tea Party movement, but also a very emboldened liberal opposition movement, Occupy Wall Street, Bernie Sanders, and the like. All that, the sort of animating force behind that is a distrust of the establishment. The media is a big part of that.
What we're seeing, I think, is even bigger than the First Amendment issues that are implicated by Christian's point. To me, did you see the Economist editorial endorsing Hillary Clinton today? There was an interesting number that they led off with, which I didn't know, and it's, you know, a little bit alarming. And the number was, a quarter of Americans born since 1980 believe that democracy is a bad form of government. I mean, those, when you see numbers like that, when you see the numbers in polls who question the extent or the ambit of the First Amendment protections, when you see these kinds of things, this is emblematic of a nation with serious issues about the fundamentals of the system that we have in place. I mean, we're seeing a moment where everything is under pressure, under question. The levels of cynicism and frustration and rage out there that got us here are profound. And it doesn't seem like any of our institutions are really moving in a direction to address it, and certainly not in the media. I mean, think about it. Well, what are we going to do about it in the media? How is the media going to change in a way that makes the public understand it any better or understand what we do? Probably nothing.
Right. I mean, it's like the more transparent the media has become, not necessarily by choice, although I think there's a little bit of choice in it with the advent of social media as a big part of reporting, but by dint of other people, of like self-appointed media watchdogs and citizen journalists calling us out, in some ways that's like a very good thing, to be held accountable on Twitter or wherever, or through WikiLeaks hacked emails for the process through which we generate the news. But in other ways, it has just elevated that distrust. It's no longer good enough for us to point to the end product and be like, read my story. If you think I'm biased, read my story and you'll see that in fact, or my body of work, that I go after both sides, and that in each story in which I'm going after one side, I'm fair even as I'm tough. Now they'll point to, oh, well, in this WikiLeaks hacked email, it shows that you said X to this source, and that becomes sort of part of the process. And that is one of the reasons why it's harder for us to have trust, is because people see this process and it's not always a clean process.
It's quite
gathering.
Ugly, actually. Yeah.
Right.
It's quite ugly.
And they see more of it. And they can call us to account on it, or they can call us to account on stuff in our stories, and we respond, and we should respond, but our responses are not exactly fixing it. In fact, in some ways, they're making it worse.
If nothing else, I hope we, both here at this news outlet, but at others, will offer a little more of a peek behind the curtain to readers, so they can understand how the news gets made, because it's clear from this election cycle that most people have no idea. The one thing that I was really stunned by was there was a little flap on Twitter I saw one day where a email had been revealed where a reporter, not a Politico reporter, basically asked one of the Clinton people for comment. So they were about to break a story and they sent an email, do you care to comment for this? And so this blows up among lots of Trump supporters on Twitter saying, see, they're in cahoots with the Clinton campaign. They're bought and sold. They're asking them for comment on the story. And like, where do you even start with that? Like, that is what we do. It's the essence of what we do. We go to both parties and get comment from them. Like, and so that, I think, is reflective of a society that has no idea what we do. And that is, and it's incumbent on us to explain it, and also to explain the value, and not in some sanctimonious, pious way, but in a way that connects with people.
You know, I used to work for a newspaper in Tacoma, Washington, the Tacoma News Tribune. I covered state politics for them. And you know, I think you would see this more, certainly more in the pre-social media era, but also in local and regional reporting, where you'd have sort of a captive audience of advertisers and people in power and business people who would at various points take issue with what the local newspaper was reporting. And the News Tribune did something that was just so effective. They would bring in people, anyone who like had a beef or just expressed an interest in the way that the news was gathered, and they would bring them in and give them a tour, and they would let them sit through the 10 a.m. or the 4 p.m. news meeting, at which like the news was, you know, all the stories were discussed and they were put up on the board, and the editors would talk about like what the news judgment was behind it and where the story should go in the paper. And these people would like maybe complain about like, why was this story, you know, that really hit my opponent hard, buried in the metro section and not on the front page, and or why was this person quoted and that person not quoted? And they would see that like, it wasn't a conspiracy. Like, the things that were going into those decisions were like, oh, the Seahawks have a huge signing. It's like a major, you know, a major victory for the Seattle Mariners in the pennant race. Or it was, one of the hottest days on record. Like, that was determining where a political story gets based and how much space there was for that story because of other news that was happening with, like, a shooting or what have you would determine how many quotes you could get into that story. And sometimes a story would get chopped and someone's quote would get lost, not because we were biased, but because there was like a horrible, you know, crime that occurred in another part of the coverage area.
Well, yeah. I mean, you said a few moments ago that you weren't sure we were going to do anything to fix it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if we as an industry are going to try to fix this. I do know I'm going to spend the entire rest of 2017 doing my own postmortem. Because I just think we, like, maybe not political. I think we've done a really excellent job of digging in and covering both campaigns in a very critical way. But doing a postmortem on our coverage and everything that contributed to what a divisive moment this was in American history. That's it for us. Before we sign off, though, I want to tell you about Nerdcast's plan for the coming week. Charlie Scott and I will record a special edition that will go live on Tuesday morning, Election Day. Our trail reporters will dial in from the scene. Then, throughout election night, Charlie and I will give quick updates on the results, and those will come at you in a Facebook Live event on Politico's page. And finally, sometime around 2 a.m., we will record a post-result show that will hit your podcast apps on Wednesday morning. Two more things. We'll do a post-mortem show that will go live at our regular time, Friday of next week. And then the week after the election, we will do a show based completely on your questions about what went down on election night. So please, please, after Tuesday night, send us all of your great questions and we'll answer them. Send them to nerdcast@politico.com. Now it's time for goodbyes. Charlie, bye-bye.
See ya.
Scott, see you later.
Take care.
Ken, go back to work.
Fun time as always.
Thank you to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and our researcher, Zach Montalaro. And of course, thank you to our listeners. Talk to you next week.